Stone said. No, sir. Stone sighed. He had never heard of Project Scoop before. The file would have to be read carefully, but it was too dark in the car to read. There would be time for that later on the airplane. He found himself thinking back over the last 5 years, back to the rather odd symposium on Long Island, and the rather odd little speaker from England who had, in his own way, begun it all. In the summer of 1962, J.J. Merrick, the English biophysicist, presented a paper to the 10th Biological Symposium at Cold Spring Harbor, Long Island. The paper was entitled, Frequencies of Biologic Contact According to Speciation Probabilities. Merrick was a rebellious, unorthodox scientist, whose reputation for clear thinking was not enhanced by his recent divorce or the presence of the handsome, blonde secretary he had brought with him to the symposium. Following the presentation of his paper, there was little serious discussion of Merrick's ideas, which were summarized at the end of the paper. I must conclude that the first contact with extraterrestrial life will be determined by the known probabilities of speciation. It is an undeniable fact that complex organisms are rare on Earth, while simple organisms flourish in abundance. There are millions of species of bacteria and thousands of species of insects. There are only a few species of primates and only four of great apes. There is but one species of man. Where this frequency of speciation goes, a corresponding frequency in numbers. Simple creatures are much more common than complex organisms. There are 3 billion men on the Earth, and that seems a great many until we consider that 10 or even 100 times that number of bacteria can be contained within a large flask. All available evidence on the origin of life points to an evolutionary progression from simple to complex life forms. This is true on Earth. It is probably true throughout the universe. Shapley, Merrow, and others have calculated the number of viable planetary systems in the near universe. My own calculations, indicated earlier in the paper, consider the relative abundance of different organisms throughout the universe. My aim has been to determine the probability of contact between man and another life form. That probability is as follows. Unicellular organisms or less, naked genetic information, 0.7840. Multicellular organisms, simple, 0.1940. Multicellular organisms, complex, but lacking coordinated central nervous system, 0.0140. Multicellular organisms with integrated organ systems, including nervous system, 0.0078. Multicellular organisms with complex nervous system capable of handling 7-plus data, human capability, 0.0002. For a total of 1.0000. These considerations lead me to believe that the first human interaction with extraterrestrial life will consist of contact with organisms similar to, if not identical to, Earth bacteria or viruses. The consequences of such contact are disturbing when one recalls that 3% of all Earth bacteria are capable of exerting some deleterious effect upon man. Later, Merrick himself considered the possibility that the first contact would consist of a plague brought back from the moon by the first man to go there. This idea was received with amusement by the assembled scientists. One of the few who took it seriously was Jeremy Stone. At the age of 36, Stone was perhaps the most famous person attending the symposium that year. He was professor of bacteriology at Berkeley, a post he had held since he was 30, and he had just won the Nobel Prize. The list of Stone's achievements, disregarding the particular series of experiments that led to the Nobel Prize, is astonishing. In 1955, he was the first to use the technique of multiplicative counts for bacterial colonies. In 1957, he developed a method for liquid-pure suspension. In 1960, Stone presented a radical new theory of operon activity in E. coli and S. tabuli and developed evidence for the physical nature of the inducer and repressor substances. His 1958 paper on linear viral transformations opened broad new lines of scientific inquiry, particularly among the Pasteur Institute group in Paris, which subsequently won the Nobel Prize in 1966. In 1961, Stone himself won the Nobel Prize. The award was given for work on bacterial mutant reversion that he had done in his spare time as a law student at Michigan when he was 26. Perhaps the most significant thing about Stone was that he had done Nobel-caliber work as a law student, for it demonstrated the depth and range of his interests. A friend once said of him, "Jeremy knows everything and is fascinated by the rest." Already he was being compared to Einstein and to Bohr as a scientist with a conscience, an overview, and appreciation of the significance of events. Physically, Stone was a thin, balding man with a prodigious memory that catalogued scientific facts and blew jokes with equal facility. But his most outstanding characteristic was a sense of impatience, the feeling he conveyed to everyone around him that they were wasting his time. He had a bad habit of interrupting speakers and finishing conversations, a habit he tried to control with only limited success. His imperious manner, when added to the fact that he had won the Nobel Prize in an early age, as well as the scandals of his private life — he was four times married, twice to the wives of colleagues — did nothing to increase his popularity. Yet it was Stone who, in the early 1960s, moved forward in government circles as one of the spokesmen for the new scientific establishment. He himself regarded this role with tolerant amusement. "A vacuum eager to be filled with hot gas," he once said. But in fact, his influence was considerable. By the early 1960s, America had reluctantly come to realize that it possessed, as a nation, the most potent scientific complex in the history of the world. 80% of all scientific discoveries in the preceding three decades had been made by Americans. The United States had 75% of the world's computers and 90% of the world's lasers. The United States had 3.5 times as many scientists as the Soviet Union and spent 3.5 times as much money on research. The U.S. had 4 times as many scientists as the European Economic Community and spent 7 times as much on research. Most of this money came, directly or indirectly, from Congress, and Congress felt a great need for men to advise them on how to spend it. During the 1950s, all the great advisors had been physicists: Teller and Oppenheimer and Bruckman and Widener. But 10 years later, with more money for biology and more concern for it, a new group emerged, led by DeBakey in Houston, Farmer in Boston, Hegerman in New York, and Stone in California. Stone's prominence was attributable to many factors: the prestige of the Nobel Prize, his political contacts, his most recent wife, the daughter of Senator Thomas Wayne of Indiana, his legal training. All this combined to assure Stone's repeated appearance before confused Senate subcommittees and gave him the power of any trusted advisor. It was this same power that he used so successfully to implement the research and construction leading to wildfire. Stone was intrigued by Merrick's ideas, which paralleled certain concepts of his own. He explained these in a short paper entitled "Sterilization of Spacecraft," printed in Science and later reprinted in the British journal Nature. The argument stated that bacterial contamination was a two-edged sword, and that man must protect against both edges. Previous to Stone's paper, most discussion of contamination dealt with the hazards to other planets of satellites and probes inadvertently carrying Earth organisms. This problem was considered early in the American space effort. By 1959, NASA had set strict regulations for sterilization of Earth origin probes. The object of these regulations was to prevent contamination of other worlds. Clearly, if a probe were being sent to Mars or Venus to search for new life forms, it would defeat the purpose of the experiment for the probe to carry Earth bacteria with it. Stone considered the reverse situation. He stated that it was equally possible for extraterrestrial organisms to contaminate the Earth via space probes. He noted that spacecraft that burned up in re-entry presented no problem, but live returns, manned flights, and probes such as the Scoop satellites were another matter entirely. Here, he said, the question of contamination was very great. His paper created a brief flurry of interest, but, as he later said, nothing very spectacular. Therefore, in 1963, he began an informal seminar group that met twice monthly in room 410 on the top floor of the University of California Medical School Biochemistry Wing for lunch and discussion of the contamination problem. It was this group of five men, Stone and John Black of Berkeley, Samuel Holden and Terence Lissette of Stanford Med, and Andrew Weiss of Stanford Biophysics, that eventually formed the early nucleus of the Wildfire Project. They presented a petition to the president in 1964, and a letter consciously patterned after the Einstein letter to Roosevelt in 1940 concerning the atomic bomb. University of California, Berkeley, California, June 10, 1964. The President of the United States, the White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C. Dear Mr. President, recent theoretical considerations suggest that sterilization procedures of returning space probes may be inadequate to guarantee sterile reentry to this planet's atmosphere. The consequence of this is the potential introduction of virulent organisms into the present terrestrial ecologic framework. It is our belief that sterilization for reentry probes and manned capsules can never be wholly satisfactory. Our calculations suggest that even if capsules received sterilizing procedures in space, the probability of contamination would still remain 1 in 10,000, and perhaps much more. These estimates are based upon organized life as we know it. Other forms of life may be entirely resistant to our sterilizing methods. We therefore urge the establishment of a facility designed to deal with an extraterrestrial life form should one inadvertently be introduced to the Earth. The purpose of this facility would be twofold: to limit dissemination of the life form and to provide laboratories for its investigation and analysis, with a view to protecting Earth life forms from its influence. We recommend that such a facility be located in an uninhabited region of the United States, that it be constructed underground, that it incorporate all known isolation techniques, and that it be equipped with a nuclear device for self-destruction in the eventuality of an emergency. So far as we know, no form of life can survive the 2 million degrees of heat which accompany an atomic nuclear detonation. Yours very truly, Jeremy Stone, John Black, Samuel Holden, Terence Lissette, Andrew Weiss. Response to the letter was gratifyingly prompt. 24 hours later, Stone received a call from one of the president's advisors, and the following day he flew to Washington to confer with the president and members of the National Security Council. 2 weeks after that, he flew to Houston to discuss further plans with NASA officials. Although Stone recalls one or two cracks about the goddamn penitentiary for bugs, most scientists he talked with regarded the project favorably. Within a month, Stone's informal team was hardened into an official committee to study problems of contamination and draw up recommendations. This committee was put on the Defense Department's Advanced Research Projects list and funded through the Defense Department. At that time, the ARPL was heavily invested in chemistry and physics, ion sprays, reversal duplication, pymezon substrates, but there was growing interest in biologic problems. Thus, one ARPL group was concerned with electronic pacing of brain function, a euphemism for mind control. A second had prepared a study of biosynergics, the future possible combinations of man and machines implanted inside the body. Still another was evaluating Project Ozma, the search for extraterrestrial life conducted in 1961 through 4. A fourth group was engaged in preliminary design of a machine that would carry out all human functions and would be self-duplicating. All these projects were highly theoretical, and all were staffed by prestigious scientists. Admission to the ARPL was a mark of considerable status, and it ensured future funds for implementation and development. Therefore, when Stone's committee submitted an early draft of the Life Analysis Protocol, which detailed the way any living thing could be studied, the Defense Department responded with an outright appropriation of $22 million for the construction of a special isolated laboratory. This rather large sum was felt to be justified since the project had application to other studies already underway. In 1965, the whole field of sterility and contamination was one of major importance. For example, NASA was building a lunar receiving laboratory, a high-security facility for Apollo astronauts returning from the moon and possibly carrying bacteria or viruses harmful to man. Every astronaut returning from the moon would be quarantined in the LRL for 3 weeks until decontamination was complete. Further, the problems of clean rooms of industry, where dust and bacteria were kept at a minimum, and the sterile chambers under study at Bethesda were also major. Aseptic environments, life islands, and sterile support systems seemed to have great future significance, and Stone's appropriation was considered a good investment in all these fields. Once money was funded, construction proceeded rapidly. The eventual result, the Wildfire Laboratory, was built in 1966 in Flat Rock, Nevada. Design was awarded to the Naval Architects of the Electric Boat Division of General Dynamics, since GD had considerable experience designing living quarters on atomic submarines, where men had to live and work for prolonged periods. The plan consisted of a conical underground structure with 5 floors. Each floor was circular, with a central service core of wiring, plumbing, and elevators. Each floor was more sterile than the one above. The first floor was non-sterile, the second moderately sterile, the third stringently sterile, and so on. Passage from one floor to another was not free. Personnel had to undergo decontamination and quarantine procedures in passing either up or down. Once the laboratory was finished, it only remained to select the Wildfire Alert Team, the group of scientists who would study any new organism. After a number of studies of team composition, 5 men were selected, including Jeremy Stone himself. These 5 were prepared to mobilize immediately in the event of a biologic emergency. Barely 2 years after his letter to the president, Stone was satisfied that this country has the capability to deal with an unknown biologic agent. He professed himself pleased with the response of Washington and the speed with which his ideas had been implemented. But privately, he admitted to friends that it had been almost too easy, that Washington had agreed to his plans almost too readily. Stone could not have known the reasons behind Washington's eagerness, or the very real concern many government officials had for the problem. For Stone knew nothing until the night he left the party and drove off in the blue military sedan, a Project Scoop. "It was the fastest thing we could arrange, sir," the army man said. Stone stepped onto the airplane with a sense of absurdity. It was a Boeing 727, completely empty, the seats stretching back in long, unbroken rows. "Sit first class if you like," the army man said, with a slight smile. "It doesn't matter." A moment later, he was gone. He was not replaced by a stewardess, but by a stern MP with a pistol on his hip, who stood by the door as the engine started, whining softly in the night. Stone sat back with a scoop file in front of him and began to read. It made fascinating reading. He went through it quickly, so quickly that the MP thought his passenger must be merely glancing at the file. But Stone was reading every word. Scoop was the brainchild of Major General Thomas Sparks, head of the Army Medical Corps, Chemical and Biological Warfare Division. Sparks was responsible for the research of the CBW installations at Fort Detrick, Maryland, Harley, Indiana, and Dugway, Utah. Stone had met him once or twice, and remembered him as being mild-mannered and bespectacled. Not the sort of man to be expected in the job he held. Reading on, Stone learned that Project Scoop was contracted to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory of the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena in 1963. Its avowed aim was the collection of any organisms that might exist in near space, the upper atmosphere of the Earth. Technically speaking, it was an Army project, but it was funded through the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, a supposedly civilian organization. In fact, NASA was a government agency with a heavy military commitment. 43% of its contractual work was classified in 1963. In theory, JPL was designing a satellite to enter the fringes of space and collect organisms and dust for study. This was considered a project of pure science, almost curiosity, and was thus accepted by all the scientists working on the study. In fact, the true aims were quite different. The true aims of SCOOP were to find new life forms that might benefit the Fort Detrick program. In essence, it was a study to discover new biological weapons of war. Detrick was a rambling structure in Maryland dedicated to the discovery of chemical and biological warfare weapons. Covering 1,300 acres, with a physical plant valued at $100 million, it ranked as one of the largest research facilities of any kind in the United States. Only 15% of its findings were published in open scientific journals. The rest were classified, as were the reports from Harley and Dugway. Harley was a maximum security installation that dealt largely with viruses. In the previous 10 years, a number of new viruses had been developed there, ranging from the variety-coded Carrination, which produces diarrhea, to the variety-coded Arnold, which causes colonic seizures and death. The Dugway Proving Ground in Utah was larger than the state of Rhode Island, and was used principally to test poison gases such as Tabun, Sklar, and Cuff-11. Few Americans, Stone knew, were aware of the magnitude of U.S. research into chemical and biological warfare. The total government expenditure in CBW exceeded $500 million a year. Much of this was distributed to academic centers such as Johns Hopkins, Pennsylvania, and the University of Chicago, where studies of weapon systems were contracted under vague terms. Sometimes, of course, the terms were not so vague. The Johns Hopkins program was devised to evaluate studies of actual or potential injuries and illnesses, studies on diseases of potential biological warfare significance, and evaluation of certain chemical and immunological responses to certain toxoids and vaccines. In the past 8 years, none of the results from Johns Hopkins had been published openly. Those from other universities, such as Chicago and UCLA, had occasionally been published, but these were considered within the military establishment to be trial balloons, examples of ongoing research intended to intimidate foreign observers. A classic was the paper by Tendron and five others entitled Researches into a Toxin Which Rapidly Uncouples Oxidative Phosphorylation Through Cutaneous Absorption. The paper described, but did not identify, a poison that would kill a person in less than a minute and was absorbed through the skin. It was recognized that this was a relatively minor achievement compared to other toxins that had been devised in recent years. With so much money and effort going into CBW, one might think that new and more virulent weapons would be continuously perfected. However, this was not the case from 1961 to 1965. The conclusion of the Senate Preparedness Subcommittee in 1961 was that conventional research has been less than satisfactory, and that new avenues and approaches of inquiry should be opened within the field. That was precisely what Major General Thomas Sparks intended to do with with Project Scoop. In final form, Scoop was a program to orbit 17 satellites around the Earth, collecting organisms and bringing them back to the surface. Stone read the summaries of each previous flight. Scoop 1 was a gold-plated satellite, cone-shaped, weighing 37 pounds, fully equipped. It was launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in Purísima, California, on March 12, 1966. Vandenberg is used for polar, north-to-south orbits, as opposed to Cape Kennedy, which launches west-to-east. Vandenberg had the additional advantage of maintaining better secrecy than Kennedy. Scoop 1 orbited for 6 days before being brought down. It landed successfully in a swamp near Athens, Georgia. Unfortunately, it was found to contain only standard Earth organisms. Scoop 2 burned up in re-entry as a result of instrumentation failure. Scoop 3 also burned up, though it had a new type of plastic and tungsten laminate heat shield. Scoops 4 and 5 were recovered intact from the Indian Ocean and the Appalachian foothills, but neither contained radically new organisms. Those collected were harmless variants of S. albus, a common contaminant of normal human skin. These failures led to a further increase in sterilization procedures prior to launch. Scoop 6 was launched on New Year's Day, 1967. It incorporated all the latest refinements from earlier attempts. High hopes rode with a revised satellite, which returned 11 days later, landing near Bombay, India. Unknown to anyone, the 34th Airborne, then stationed in Evreux, France, just outside Paris, was dispatched to recover the capsule. The 34th was on alert whenever a spaceflight went up, according to the procedures of Operation Scrub, a plan first devised to protect Mercury and Gemini capsules should one be forced to land in Soviet Russia or Eastern Bloc countries. Scrub was the primary reason for keeping a single paratroop division in Western Europe in the first half of the 1960s. Scoop 6 was recovered uneventfully. It was found to contain a previously unknown form of unicellular organism, cocobacillary in shape, gram-negative, coagulase, and triokinase positive. However, it proved generally benevolent to all living things, with the exception of domestic female chickens, which had made moderately ill for a 4-day period. Among the Dietrich staff, hope dimmed for the successful recovery of a pathogen from the Scoop program. Nonetheless, Scoop 7 was launched soon after Scoop 6. The exact date is classified, but it is believed to be February 5, 1967. Scoop 7 immediately went into stable orbit with an apogee of 317 miles and a perigee of 224 miles. It remained in orbit for 2.5 days. At that time, the satellite abruptly left stable orbit for unknown reasons, and it was decided to bring it down by radio command. The anticipated landing site was a desolate area in northeastern Arizona. Midway through the flight, his reading was interrupted by an officer who brought him a telephone and then stepped a respectful distance away while Stone talked. "Yes?" Stone said, feeling odd. He was not accustomed to talking on the telephone in the middle of an airplane trip. "General Marcus here," a tired voice said. Stone did not know General Marcus. "I just wanted to inform you that all the members of the team have been called in, with the exception of Professor Kirk." "What happened?" "Professor Kirk is in the hospital," General Marcus said. "You'll get further details when you touch down." The conversation ended. Stone gave the telephone back to the officer. He thought for a minute about the other men on the team and wondered at their reactions as they were called out of bed. There was Levitt, of course. He would respond quickly. Levitt was a clinical microbiologist, a man experienced in the treatment of infectious disease. Levitt had seen enough plagues and epidemics in his day to know the importance of quick action. Besides, there was his ingrained pessimism, which never deserted him. Levitt once said, "At my wedding, all I could think of was how much alimony she'd cost me." He was an irritable, grumbling, heavy-set man, with a morose face and sad eyes, which seemed to peer ahead into a bleak and miserable future. But he was also thoughtful, imaginative, and not afraid to think daringly. Then there was the pathologist, Burton, in Houston. Stone had never liked Burton very well, though he acknowledged his scientific talent. Burton and Stone were different. Where Stone was organized, Burton was sloppy. Where Stone was controlled, Burton was impulsive. Where Stone was confident, Burton was nervous, jumpy, petulant. Colleagues referred to Burton as the stumbler, partly because of his tendency to trip over his untied shoelaces and baggy trouser cuffs, and partly because of his talent for tumbling by error into one important discovery after another. And then Kirk, the anthropologist from Yale, who apparently was not going to be able to come. If the report was true, Stone knew he was going to miss him. Kirk was an ill-informed and rather foppish man who possessed, as if by accident, a superbly logical brain. He was capable of grasping the essentials of a problem and manipulating them to get the necessary result. Though he could not balance his own checkbook, mathematicians often came to him for help in resolving highly abstract problems. Stone was going to miss that kind of brain. Certainly the fifth man would be no help. Stone frowned as he thought about Mark Hall. Hall had been a compromised candidate for the team. Stone would have preferred a physician with experience in metabolic disease, and the choice of a surgeon instead had been made with the greatest reluctance. There had been great pressure from the defense and the AEC to accept Hall, since those groups believed in the odd man hypothesis. In the end, Stone and the others had given in. Stone did not know Hall well. He wondered what he would say when he was informed of the alert. Stone could not have known of the great delay in notifying members of the team. He did not know, for instance, that Burton, the pathologist, was not called until 5 a.m., or that Peter Levitt, the microbiologist, was not called until 6:30, the time he arrived at the hospital. And Hall was not called until 5 minutes past seven. It was, Mark Hall said later, a horrifying experience. In an instant, I was taken from the most familiar of worlds and plunged into the most unfamiliar. At 6:45, Hall was in the washroom adjacent to the OR-7, scrubbing for his first case of the day. He was in the midst of a routine he had carried out daily for several years. He was relaxed and joking with a resident, scrubbing with him. When he finished, he went into the operating room, holding his arms before him, and the instrument nurse handed him a towel to wipe his hands dry. Also in the room was another resident, who was prepping the body for surgery, applying iodine and alcohol solutions, and a circulating nurse. They all exchanged greetings. At the hospital, Hall was known as a swift, quick-tempered, and unpredictable surgeon. He operated with speed, working nearly twice as fast as other surgeons. When things went smoothly, he laughed and joked as he worked, kidding his assistants, the nurses, the anesthetist. But if things did not go well, if they became slow and difficult, Hall could turn blackly irritable. Like most surgeons, he was insistent upon routine. Everything had to be done in a certain order, in a certain way. If not, he became upset. Because the others in the operating room knew this, they looked up toward the overhead viewing gallery with apprehension when Levitt appeared. Levitt clicked on the intercom that connected the upstairs room to the operating room below and said, "Hello, Mark." Paul had been draping the patient, placing green sterile cloths over every part of the body except for the abdomen. He looked up with surprise. "Hello, Peter," he said.
"Oh, sorry to disturb you," Levitt said. "But this is an emergency."
"I have to wait," Paul said. "I'm starting a procedure." He finished draping and called for the skin knife. He palpated the abdomen, feeling for the landmarks to begin his incision.
"It can't wait," Levitt said.
Paul paused. He set down the scalpel and looked up. There was a long silence. "What the hell do you mean, it can't wait?" Levitt remained calm.
"You have to break, scrub. This is an emergency. Look, Peter, I've got a patient here, anesthetized, ready to go. I can't just walk. Kelly will take over for you. Kelly was one of the staff surgeons. Kelly?
He's scrubbing now, Levitt said. It's all arranged. I'll expect to meet you in the surgeon's change room in about 30 seconds.
And then he was gone. Hall glared at everyone in the room. No one moved or spoke. After a moment, he stripped off his gloves and stomped out of the room, swearing once, very loudly. Hall viewed his own association with wildfire as tenuous at best. In 1966, he had been approached by Levitt, the chief of bacteriology of the hospital, who had explained in a sketchy way the purpose of the project. Hall found it all rather amusing and had agreed to join the team if his services ever became necessary. Privately, he was confident that nothing would ever come of wildfire. Levitt had offered to give Hall the files on wildfire and to keep him up to date on the project. At first, Hall politely took the files, but it soon became clear that he was not bothering to read them, and so Levitt stopped giving them to him. If anything, this pleased Hall, who preferred not to have his desk cluttered. A year before, Levitt had asked him whether he wasn't curious about something that he had agreed to join and that might at some future time prove dangerous. Hall had said, no. Now, in the doctor's room, Hall regretted those words. The doctor's room was a small place, lined on all four walls with lockers. There were no windows. A large coffee maker sat in the center of the room, with a stack of paper cups alongside. Levitt was pouring himself a cup, his solemn basset hound face looking mournful.
This is going to be awful coffee, he said. You can't get a decent cup anywhere in a hospital. Hurry and change.
Hall said, do you mind telling me first why?
I mind, Levitt said. Change. There's a car waiting outside, and we're already late. Perhaps too late.
He had a gruffly, melodramatic way of speaking that had always annoyed Hall. There was a loud slurp as Levitt sipped the coffee.
Just as I suspected, he said. How can you tolerate it? Hurry, please.
Hall unlocked his locker and kicked it open. He leaned against the door and stripped away the black plastic shoe covers that were worn in the operating room to prevent buildup of static charges. Next, I suppose you're going to tell me this has to do with that damn project?
Exactly, Levitt said. And now try to hurry. The car is waiting to take us to the airport, and the morning traffic is bad.
Hall changed quickly, not thinking, his mind momentarily stunned. Somehow, he had never thought it possible. He dressed and walked out with Levitt toward the hospital entrance. Outside, in the sunshine, he could see the olive U.S. Army sedan pulled up to the curb, its light flashing. And he had a sudden, horrible realization that Levitt was not kidding, that nobody was kidding, and that some kind of awful nightmare was coming true. For his own part, Peter Levitt was irritated with Hall. In general, Levitt had little patience with practicing physicians. Though he had an M.D. degree, Levitt had never practiced, preferring to devote his time to research. His field was clinical microbiology and epidemiology, and his specialty was parasitology. He had done parasitic research all over the world. His work had led to the discovery of the Brazilian tapeworm, Tinea renzi, which he had characterized in a paper in 1953. As he grew older, however, Levitt had stopped traveling. Public health, he was fond of saying, was a young man's game. When you got your fifth case of intestinal amebiasis, it was time to quit. Levitt got his fifth case in Rhodesia in 1955. He was dreadfully sick for 3 months and lost 40 pounds. Afterward, he resigned his job in the public health service. He was offered the post of chief of microbiology at the hospital, and he had taken it, with the understanding that he would be able to devote a good portion of his time to research. Within the hospital, he was known as a superb clinical bacteriologist, but his real interest remained parasites.
In the period from 1955 to 1964, he published a series of elegant metabolic studies on Ascaris and Nicator that were highly regarded by other workers in the field. Levitt's reputation had made him a natural choice for Wildfire, and it was through Levitt that Hall had been asked to join. Levitt knew the reasons behind Hall's selection, though Hall did not. When Levitt had asked him to join, Hall had demanded to know why. "I'm just a surgeon," he had said.
"Yes," Levitt said. "But you know electrolytes."
"So?"
"That may be important. Blood chemistries, pH, acidity and alkalinity, the whole thing. That may be vital when the time comes."
"But there are a lot of electrolyte people," Hall had pointed out. "Many of them better than me."
"Yes," Levitt had said, "but they're all married."
"So what?"
"We need a single man."
"Why?"
"It's necessary that one member of the team be unmarried."
"That's crazy," Hall had said.
"Maybe," Levitt had said. "Maybe not."
They left the hospital and walked up to the army sedan. A young officer was waiting stiffly and saluted as they came up. "Dr. Hall?"
"Yes."
"May I see your card, please?" Hall gave him the little plastic card with his picture on it. He had been carrying the card in his wallet for more than a year. It was a rather strange card, with just a name, a picture, and a thumbprint, nothing more. Nothing to indicate that it was an official card. The officer glanced at it, then at Hall, and back to the card. He handed it back. "Very good, sir." He opened the rear door of the sedan. Hall got in, and Levitt followed, shielding his eyes from the flashing red light on the car top. Hall noticed it. "Something wrong?"
"No. Just never liked flashing lights. Reminds me of my days as an ambulance driver during the war."
Levitt settled back, and the car started off.
"Now then," he said. "When we reach the airfield, you'll be given a file to read during the trip."
"What trip?"
"You'll be taking in F-104, Levitt said.
"Where?"
"Nevada. Try to read the file on the way. Once we arrive, things will be very busy."
"And the others in the team?" Levitt glanced at his watch.
"Kirk has appendicitis and is in the hospital. The others have already begun work. Right now, they're in a helicopter over Piedmont, Arizona."
"Never heard of it," Hall said.
"Nobody has," Levitt said. "Until now."
6. Piedmont. At 9:59 a.m., on the same morning, a K-4 jet helicopter lifted off the concrete of Vandenberg's maximum security hangar, MSH-9, and headed east toward Arizona. The decision to lift off from an MSH was made by Major Manchek, who was concerned about the attention the suits might draw. Because inside the helicopter were three men, a pilot and two scientists, and all three wore clear plastic inflatable suits, making them look like obese men from Mars, or, as one of the hangar maintenance men put it, like balloons from the Macy's parade. As the helicopter climbed into the clear morning sky, the two passengers in the belly looked at each other. One was Jeremy Stone, the other Charles Burton. Both men had arrived at Vandenberg just a few hours before. Stone from Stanford, and Burton from Baylor University in Houston. Burton was 54, a pathologist. He held a professorship at Baylor Medical School and served as a consultant to the NASA Manned Spaceflight Center in Houston. Earlier, he had done research at the National Institutes of Bethesda. His field had been the effects of bacteria on human tissues. It is one of the peculiarities of scientific development that such a vital field was virtually untouched when Burton came into it. Though men had known germs caused disease since Henley's hypothesis of 1840, by the middle of the 20th century, There was still nothing known about why or how bacteria did their damage. The specific mechanisms were unknown. Burton began, like so many others in his day, with Diplococcus pneumoniae, the agent causing pneumonia. There was great interest in pneumococcus before the advent of penicillin in the 40s. After that, both interest and research money evaporated. Burton shifted to Staphylococcus aureus, a common skin pathogen responsible for pimples and boils. At the time he began his work, his fellow researchers laughed at him. Staphylococcus, like pneumococcus, was highly sensitive to penicillin. They doubted Burton would ever get enough money to carry on his work. For 5 years, they were right. The money was scarce, and Burton often had to go begging to foundations and philanthropists. Yet he persisted, patiently elucidating the coats of the cell wall that caused a reaction in host tissue, and helping to discover the half-dozen toxins secreted by the bacteria to break down tissue, spread infection, and destroy red cells. Suddenly, in the 1950s, the first penicillin-resistant strains of staph appeared. The new strains were virulent and produced bizarre deaths, often by brain abscess. Almost overnight, Burton found his work had assumed major importance. Dozens of labs around the country were changing over to study staph. It was a hot field. In a single year, Burton watched his grant appropriations jump from $6,000 a year to $300,000. Soon afterward, he was made a professor of pathology. Looking back, Burton felt no great pride in his accomplishment. It was, he knew, a matter of luck, of being in the right place and doing the right work when the time came. He wondered what would come of being here, in this helicopter, now. Sitting across from him, Jeremy Stone tried to conceal his distaste for Burton's appearance. Beneath the plastic suit, Burton wore a dirty, plaid sports shirt with a stain on the left breast pocket. His trousers were creased and frayed, and even his hair, Stone felt, was unruly and untidy. He stared out the window, forcing himself to think of other matters. 50 people, he said, shaking his head. Dead within 8 hours of the landing of Scoop 7. The question is one of spread. Presumably airborne, Burton said. Yes, presumably. Everyone seems to have died in the immediate vicinity of the town, Burton said. Are there reports of deaths farther out? Stone shook his head. I'm having the army people look into it. They're working with the highway patrol. So far, no deaths have turned up outside.
Wind?
A stroke of luck, Stone said. Last night the wind was fairly brisk, 9 miles an hour to the south and steady. But around midnight, it died. Pretty unusual for this time of year, they tell me. But fortunate for us. Yes, Stone nodded. We're fortunate in another way as well. There is no important area of habitation for a radius of nearly 112 miles. Outside that, of course, there is Las Vegas to the north, San Bernardino to the west, and Phoenix to the east. Not nice, if the bug gets to any of them.
But as long as the wind stays down, we have time.
Presumably, Stone said. For the next half hour, the two men discussed the vector problem with frequent reference to a sheaf of output maps drawn up during the night by Vandenberg's computer division. The output maps were highly complex analyses of geographic problems. In this case, the maps were visualizations of the southwestern United States, weighted for wind direction and population. Discussion then turned to the time course of death. Both men had heard the tape from the van. They agreed that everyone at Piedmont seemed to have died quite suddenly.
Even if you slit a man's throat with a razor, Burton said, you won't get death that rapidly. Cutting both carotids and jugulars still allows 10 to 40 seconds before unconsciousness and nearly a minute before death.
At Piedmont, it seems to have occurred in a second or two. Burton shrugged. Trauma, he suggested.
A blow to the head?
Yes. Or nerve gas?
Certainly possible.
It's that or something very much like it, Stone said. If it was an enzymatic block of some kind, like arsenic or strychnine, we'd expect 15 or 30 seconds, perhaps longer. But a block of nervous transmission, or a block of the neuromuscular junction, or cortical poisoning, that could be very swift. It could be instantaneous.
If it is a fast-acting gas, Burton said, it must have high diffusibility across the lungs.
Or the skin, Stone said. Mucous membranes, anything, any porous surface. Burton touched the plastic of his suit.
If this gas is so highly diffusible, Stone gave a slight smile. We'll find out soon enough.
Over the intercom, the helicopter pilot said, Piedmont approaching, gentlemen. Please advise.
Stone said,
circle once and give us a look at it. The helicopter banked steeply. The two men looked out and saw the town below them. The buzzards had landed during the night and were thickly clustered around the bodies.
I was afraid of that, Stone said. They may represent a vector for infectious spread, Burton said. Eat the meat of infected people and carry the organisms away with them.
Stone nodded, staring out the window.
What do we do?
Gas them, Stone said. He flicked on the intercom to the pilot. Have you got the canisters?
Yes, sir.
Circle again, and blanket the town.
Yes, sir.
The helicopter tilted and swung back. Soon the two men could not see the ground for the clouds of pale blue gas.
What is it?
Chlorazine, Stone said. Highly effective in low concentrations on aviary metabolism. Birds have a high metabolic rate. They are creatures that consist of little more than feathers and muscle. Their heartbeats are usually about 120, and many species eat more than their own weight every day.
The gas is an uncoupler.
Yes, it'll hit them hard. The helicopter banked away, then hovered. The gas slowly cleared in the gentle wind, moving off to the south. Soon they could see the ground again. Hundreds of birds lay there. A few flapped their wings spastically, but most were already dead. Stone frowned as he watched. Somewhere in the back of his mind, he knew he had forgotten something, or ignored something. Some fact, some vital clue that the birds provided and he must not overlook. Over the intercom, the pilot said,
Your order, sir.
Go to the center of the main street, Stone said, and drop the rope ladder. You are to remain 20 feet above the ground. Do not put down. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
When we've climbed down, you are to lift off to an altitude of 500 feet.
Yes, sir.
Return when we signal you.
Yes, sir.
And should anything happen to us, I proceed directly to wildfire, the pilot said, his voice dry.
Correct.
The pilot knew what that meant. He was being paid according to the highest Air Force pay scales. He was drawing regular pay plus hazardous duty pay, plus non-wartime special services pay, plus mission over hostile territory pay, plus bonus airtime pay. He would receive more than $1,000 for this day's work, and his family would receive an additional $10,000 from the short-term life insurance should he not return. There was a reason for the money. If anything happened to Burton and Stone on the ground, the pilot was ordered to fly directly to the wildfire installation and hover 30 feet above ground until such time as the wildfire group had determined the correct way to incinerate him and his airplane. In midair. He was being paid to take a risk. He had volunteered for the job, and he knew that high above, circling at 20,000 feet, was an Air Force jet with air-to-air missiles. It was the job of the jet to shoot down the helicopter should the pilot suffer a last-minute loss of nerve and fail to go directly to wildfire.
Don't slip up, the pilot said.
Sir. The helicopter maneuvered over the main street of the town and hung in midair. There was a rattling sound, the rope ladder being released. Stone stood and pulled on his helmet. He snapped shut the sealer and inflated his clear suit, puffing it up around him. A small bottle of oxygen on his back would provide enough air for 2 hours of exploration. He waited until Burton had sealed his suit, and then Stone opened the hatch and stared down at the ground. The helicopter was raising a heavy cloud of dust. Stone clicked on his radio.
All set?
All set. Stone began to climb down the ladder. Burton waited a moment, then followed. He could see nothing in the swirling dust, but finally felt his shoes touch the ground. He released the ladder and looked over. He could barely make out Stone's suit, a dim outline in a gloomy, dusky world. The ladder pulled away as the helicopter lifted into the sky. The dust cleared. They could see.
"Let's go," Stone said. Moving clumsily in their suits, they walked down the main street of Piedmont.
7. An unusual process. Scarcely 12 hours after the first known human contact with the Andromeda strain was made at Piedmont, Burton and Stone arrived in the town. Weeks later, in their debriefing sessions, both men recalled the scene vividly and described it in detail. The morning sun was still low in the sky. It was cold and cheerless, casting long shadows over the thinly snow-crusted ground. From where they stood, they could look up and down the street at the gray, weathered wooden buildings. But what they noticed first was the silence. Except for a gentle wind that whined softly through the empty houses, it was deathly silent. Bodies lay everywhere, heaped and flung across the ground in attitudes of frozen surprise. But there was no sound. No reassuring rumble of an automobile engine, no barking dog, no shouting children. Silence. The two men looked at each other. They were painfully aware of how much there was to learn, to do. Some catastrophe had struck this town, and they must discover all they could about it, but they had practically no clues, no points of departure. They knew, in fact, only two things. First, that the trouble apparently began with the landing of Scoop 7, and second, that death had overtaken the people of the town with astonishing rapidity. If it was a disease from the satellite, then it was like no other in the history of medicine. For a long time, the men said nothing, but stood in the street, looking about them, feeling the wind tug at their oversized suits. Finally, Stone said, "Why are they all outside, in the street? If this was a disease that arrived at night, most of the people would be indoors."
"And not only that," Burton said, "they're mostly wearing pajamas. It was a cold night last night. You'd think that they would have stopped to put on a jacket or a raincoat, something to keep them warm. Maybe they were in a hurry."
"To do what?" Burton said.
To see something," Stone said, with a helpless shrug.
Burton bent over the first body they came to.
"Odd," he said. "Look at the way this fellow's clutching his chest. Quite a few of them are doing that."
Looking at the bodies, Stone saw that the hands of many were pressed to their chests, some flat, some clawing.
"They didn't seem to be in pain," Stone said. "Their faces are quite peaceful."
"Almost astonished, in fact," Burton nodded. "These people look cut down, caught in mid-stride, but clutching their chests."
"Coronary?" Stone said.
"Doubt it. They should grimace. It's painful, the same with a pulmonary embolus."
"If it was fast enough, they wouldn't have time."
Perhaps, but somehow I think these people died a painless death, which means they're clutching their chest because
they couldn't breathe," Stone said.
Burton nodded. It's possible we're seeing asphyxiation, rapid, painless, almost instantaneous asphyxiation, but I doubt it. If a person can't breathe, the first thing he does is loosen his clothing, particularly around the neck and chest. Look at that man.